Luke 15, Parables of the Lost, the 24th talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits, was presented by Larry Barber on April 21, 1998, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
This is a series that we're doing. It's called The Greatest Hits, I think. And so I get to teach not only three passages over the next tonight and the next 2 weeks that I think are good passages and helpful passages, but they're passages that I really like. The passages I'd like to talk about this evening is what is it's found in Luke 15. If you want to turn there, that'd be great. There's actually three parables in this particular passage. There's the parable of the lost sheep, the parable of the lost coin, and what many Christians have referred to as the parable of the prodigal son. The context for Jesus telling these three parables is found in verses 1 and 2 in chapter 15. And it reads, "Now all of the tax gatherers and sinners were coming near to him to listen to him. And both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.'" So the circumstances for this, for the parables, is the offense that the scribes and the Pharisees have with Jesus, with these people following Jesus, with the tax gatherers and sinners following Jesus, and then Jesus welcoming them and sharing a meal with them. That's the circumstance surrounding Jesus telling these parables, and that's important. I want to take a few minutes and just sort of look at these people that Luke identifies. There's four people. There's the Pharisees, the scribes, the tax gatherers, and sinners. And I'd like to just sort of identify these four people, groups of people, so that you have a good feel for who we're talking about. A tax gatherer is an interesting person. When Israel became a Roman province, the Romans had a very unique way of collecting taxes. They would sell a tax franchise to a Jewish person, kind of like a McDonald's thing. And the person who wanted that tax franchise, actually it was a Roman government official called a censor, and he would sell this franchise to the highest bidder. And the reason that people wanted to, and this is a very lucrative position. It was a very desired thing in one sense because you could make a lot of money. And what would happen is that the censor would sell this tax franchise to this anybody, and then that gave him the right to collect taxes in a certain district. And then the censor would also set a quota for how much taxes had to be collected in that district. And then any money that the tax gatherer collected over and above that set quota was his. And there was nothing to stop him or prevent him from collecting as much as he wanted. So people were willing to pay a whole lot of money for these franchises, for the right to collect taxes, because you could make a whole lot of money. And so tax gatherers were not only wealthy on one hand, but they were not very popular on the other because they were considered unclean because they had dealings with the Romans who were Gentiles. They were considered traitors because they were Jewish people who were collecting money from their fellow countrymen. They were barred from the synagogues. They were sort of put in the category of murderers and adulterers and sinners. And they were kind of considered, people who oppressed their fellow countrymen. So that's who the tax gatherer is. The next person that Luke identifies is a sinner. And a sinner was the a term that was used by the Pharisees to describe the common people. These people who were people who, through either kind of ignorance of the law or just indifference, and they didn't care, they failed to observe the law. They were not obedient to the law. They were considered immoral. They were considered outcast. And people who were really serious about their relationship with God didn't associate with these people. And these are the people, these are tax gatherers and sinners, are the people that are following Jesus. They're listening to him, and he welcomes them and shares this meal with them. And the next two groups of people are what's the Pharisees and the scribes. The Pharisees are, the word Pharisee actually means separated ones. And the Pharisees were a group of people who kind of banded together, kind of like a Bible study or a fraternity. And they were generally led by a scribe, and we'll talk about what a scribe here is in a second. And the purpose of their sort of getting together in these little groups was to sort of educate themselves as to the law and what's called the oral traditions. The law is obviously the Mosaic law, and the oral traditions are the written or oral translations or interpretations of the law. And they came to have a very prominent place in that culture. They were actually as important as the law itself. So for a Pharisee, knowing the law and knowing the oral traditions was very, very important. It was really one of the most important ways that they could express their faith in God. The Pharisees were very sincere. They were deeply religious. They were respected. They were devoted to striving after godliness as they understood it. They saw themselves as the keepers of the faith. They saw themselves as protectors of the law. These were the people who they saw themselves as people who God had called to guard and protect the law against contamination. What they did, the activities that they did, they're going to church and all the laws that they kept and the tithing and all that stuff, was motivated by a desire to qualify themselves for eternal life. And the Pharisees believed that to the extent that they worked hard in keeping the law and keeping the oral traditions, to that extent, and to the extent that they were somewhat successful at that, that qualified them for God's grace. I mean, they realized in some level that they were sinners, but there was this real connection between how hard they tried and how successful they were at keeping the law that qualified them for grace, and that grace really sort of got them this thing they were after called eternal life. The next group is Luke identifies as the scribes. And a scribe the term scribe and lawyer in the New Testament are used interchangeably. And a scribe was a person who was an Old Testament scholar. He knew the law almost literally inside and out and forwards and backwards. A scribe devoted himself to studying, to interpreting, and to trying to determine what the exact intent of a particular law was, so that you could obey the law. Then the logic was, if you didn't know the law or the oral traditions, then you couldn't obey the law. If you knew it, then you could obey it. The scribe devoted himself to teaching the law. The Pharisees had this belief or this notion that every Jew obeyed the law for one day, that the Messiah would come, that somehow would usher in the Messiah. And so communicating the law, knowing the law and communicating the law was really important to them. Another thing that the scribes did was they really devoted themselves to the practical administration of the law. So they would study it, they would interpret it. And so if there came a question, if someone had a question about, well, what is this, how does this law apply here? Or is this right, or is this wrong, or what does this mean, or what does this law mean, or how do we apply this law? The people would come to a scribe and would ask him, and he would be looked upon to give them the correct answer. So this is a person who's respected, a person who's looked up to. It's a pretty prominent person, pretty important person in that culture. This group of men, these scribes and Pharisees, they believed that they were on the best possible terms with God. They believed sincerely that they had it right. These guys are the theologically correct of the first century. They are the ones who are trusting God. And included in their perception or their perspective of the law and how they interpreted the law, those people who were serious about keeping the law would not associate with sinners and tax gatherers. And so from their perspective, what Jesus is doing doesn't make any sense to them. Jesus is saying that he's from God on the one hand, and yet he is associating with sinners and tax gatherers on the other hand. And this does not compute for them, because again, their perception is that's not what you do if you're really serious about pleasing God. Jesus is consistently doing things that are very different from what these guys, what they think, and what they would say or what they would do. And yet, again, he claims to be from God. And rather than consider the possibility that their understanding of God, their understanding of what a relationship with God looks like, rather than think or consider that they might be wrong in their thinking about how they think about these people or whether they ought to associate with these people, rather than think that or question that, they kind of take the easy road. They take the path of least resistance, and they're critical of Jesus. Rather than asking Jesus, hey, what are you thinking about this, or how do you make sense of this? You know, this is how we think about it. What are you doing? Why are you doing it? They didn't. They were just critical. Now, I want to kind of help us for a second sort of identify with these people here and understand. I think it'll help us really understand what these parables are about. I want you to imagine, if you can, I don't know if how this will go, but I want you to think about what would it like for a moment, to be there. We're back there, and we're all scribes and Pharisees and sinners and tax gatherers, and I don't know who you are, or who you want to be, but you're a tax gatherer. Okay, we got any scribes or Pharisees here? But I mean, what's that? You're a Pharisee. Okay, let's get into this. We got any actors back here? Let's get into these roles. Okay, imagine that you're a tax gatherer or a sinner. Imagine that you might be a Pharisee or a scribe for a moment. Now imagine what it would be like if Jesus walked through this door and he sat right here. What would you think? Okay, he's sitting right over there by Tucker, who is a really huge sinner. Okay? What would you think about that if you're a Pharisee over here? Or Gabe, if you're a Pharisee here, what would that be like if Jesus sat right by Tucker? I mean, but okay, right, but this is sort of the intellectual process that you go through here, but emotionally, psychologically, what are you doing with that?
You're having
a really hard time with this. Yeah. I mean, this guy's Jesus, he's saying, I'm from God, and he's sitting over there with this sinner.
So we've got
a major tension here, yeah. Major conflict here. So I want you to get this. This is not an intellectual exercise. This is Jesus sitting right there.
Okay.
And he's creating a huge conflict, a huge internal conflict for these guys, a huge psychological conflict. What do they do with this? Do they question themselves? No. You're getting on Jesus' case here, man. You're saying, Jesus, what are you... You're not even saying it to him. You're talking to your other buddy over here who's a Pharisee like you, and you're saying, get this guy. And you're kind of intellectualizing and rationalizing all the stuff you do, and you do it right, and this is how you do it, and Jesus, look at him, look what he's doing wrong. That's the kind of stuff that's going on here. So you see the psychology of that, okay? Does that make sense? So there's this tension here. There's not only this sort of tension you feel interpersonally, but there's this intrapersonal thing going on too, this inside conflict, this conflict that's going on inside these guys. Okay? So there's a huge problem here. Okay?
Exactly did they know about Jesus at this point?
Well, Jesus at this point has been around for a while. So
would they have considered him someone who should have been doing what they were doing by vocation, or what? Or does that really matter?
I don't know that they would vocationally, but they would definitely think that Jesus would, if Jesus was really serious in his about his relationship with God,
which that he had already claimed to be.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Then they're so rigid. And their way of looking at this is so narrow. And Jesus is outside the lines here. And they're saying, this doesn't compute. This doesn't work. They're saying it can't be true that Jesus can be from God on the one hand and be doing it differently than we are. It doesn't compute for them. And so that's why there's this tension. Okay?
I was going to say, the other thing, other than just being a smart teacher, he was doing a lot of miracles.
That's right.
Which should be amazing to anyone, and should make them look legitimate.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think there's another piece here, the psychology here, and that is that there's a lot of people, tax gatherers and sinners, who are following Jesus. He's popular with them. They like him. They're coming to him. They're following him because they like what. Because what he's saying is very different from what the Pharisees and the tax gatherers are saying. Very different message. He's saying, come on, God has mercy, God's forgiving. Okay, very different message. So there's some psychology here, maybe some jealousy, that these guys are Jesus is getting a lot of attention from these people, from the common people. Okay?
We've got the scribes, too, whose entire livelihood is being threatened. If you do away with the law, we need to analyze it letter by letter.
Well, if... I have to think about that. Perhaps, maybe their livelihood is at stake in the sense that he's telling them that they're wrong, that they got it wrong. I don't think he's saying, Jesus wouldn't be saying, let's get rid of the law at all. But he would say, how you look at it is wrong. Mm-hmm. So that would threaten their position, if you will. So in that sense. Let me go on here. So we got that, you kind of feel that conflict there, that tension, okay? That's what's there. So Jesus begins the series of parables with a phrase, and he says, "What men among you?" And he's kind of saying, he's kind of appealing to their own experience, their own common sense. And he's kind of putting the ball in their court, and he's saying, what do you guys say about this? What do you think about this? And then he tells the parables. Let me look at the first parable. Excuse me. Verse 3 through 6. He says, "What man among you, if he has 100 sheep and has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost.'" And there's two points I want to make about this parable, this part of this parable. First of all, the risk involved in leaving the 99 sheep unattended without attention in the open pasture, and the effort, the sacrifice of the effort and the searching for the one lost sheep demonstrates how important and how valuable the one sheep is to the shepherd. Okay? That's important here. Secondly, as a result of finding the one lost sheep, the shepherd rejoices. And he goes home and he invites his friends to rejoice with him. Okay? Then Jesus makes a comment about these two verses, or what he's just said to the Pharisees and scribes. He says, he makes a correlation between the lost sheep being found and a sinner repenting. And similarly to the rejoicing by the shepherd, when the shepherd finds the sheep and rejoices, and his friends rejoice with him, to that the fact that there will be rejoicing in heaven when one sinner repents. So what Jesus is doing here, let me read that verse. He says, "I tell you that in that same way, there will be more joy in heaven when over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous person who needs no repentance." So what Jesus is doing, he is taking this parable, this story this analogy, and he is applying it to the situation right now. He's applying it to the Pharisees and the scribes and saying, he's kind of challenging their attitude about how they're thinking about these people. So he's taking the parable and he's saying, it applies here. Okay? Let's look at the second parable. This is a parable about a lost coin, verse 8 and 9. Or what woman, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and search carefully until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the coin which I had lost. Again, there's two points here, I think. First of all, the effort that the woman takes in looking for the coin. She searches all over. She cleans her house. She sweeps it. So this effort demonstrates how valuable and how important finding this lost coin is. Secondly, again, as a result of finding the coin, she's happy. She's rejoicing. And she goes and she invites her friends to share this, her joy with her, to rejoice with her in the fact that this coin, she found the coin that was lost. Again, Jesus does the same thing, and he takes this and he applies this parable, this little story, to the situation here. He says, in the same way, I tell you there's... excuse me, I got ahead of myself. Again, in the commentary of the parable, Jesus in verse 10, Jesus makes a correlation between the lost coin being found on the one hand and a sinner repenting. And similarly to the rejoicing of the friends of the woman to... there will be rejoicing in heaven over one sinner repents. He says, in the same way I tell you, there is joy in the presence of angels of God over one sinner who repents. So again, Jesus is taking this story and he is applying it to this situation. Okay? Let me make a couple comments about these two parables, these two short parables, and then we'll move on to the last one. First comment I'd like to make is that the shepherd and the woman in these parables are intended to be pictures of God. From Jesus' perspective, they demonstrate the attitude that God has towards those who are lost. God is willing to put great effort and great sacrifice into recovering those who are lost. Those who are lost are valuable to God. Secondly, the lost sheep and the lost coin in these parables represent the tax gatherers and the sinners that Jesus is associating with. And thirdly, those who are friends of the shepherd and the woman rejoiced with them over the recovery of that what was lost. Likewise, those who are friends of God will rejoice with God over the recovery of those who are lost. That's the moral of the story. This is a huge statement that Jesus is making. He's saying that the Pharisees and the scribes are not friends of God. If they were friends of God, they would rejoice over the recovery of the lost. Instead, they are being critical. They're grumbling. So Jesus is confronting this attitude, this perspective of the scribes and the Pharisees, and that attitude that they have towards the Pharisees, the sinners and tax gatherers. He's saying, since the Pharisees and the scribes are criticizing Jesus instead of rejoicing with him over his efforts to recover the lost, they must not be friends of God. This is a huge statement. Okay. He's saying that they're not the friends of God that they think they are. Okay, let's move on. This is the last parable in this section, in this chapter, and this is a parable that I think I suggested before that it's probably the most well-known parable in all of the Bible, and it's referred to as the parable of the prodigal son. I'd like to make three comments about this parable before we actually look at it. And the first is that this is not a parable about a son, about one son. This is a parable about a father and two sons. This is a parable about a father and two sons who have very different perspectives about the father and how those perspectives, different perspectives, play themselves out in how they think about the Father, how they think about themselves, and how particularly how the younger, older son thinks about the younger son. That's what this parable is about. So it's not just a parable about the prodigal son. Secondly, we're used to thinking about this parable, and this is a really nice story. This is a nice story about how a wayward son comes to his senses and he comes back home. The father welcomes him back home and it's a happy ending. And that's how we think about the story. This parable is intended to confront and to expose and challenge the perspective and attitude of the Pharisees and scribes regarding how they think about themselves, how they think about God, and how that affects how they think about other people who are different than they are. Okay? So this is not a nice story. Jesus is getting in these guys' face. He is confronting them. So we need to think about this parable, I think, differently than we often do. One second. If we're going to understand the significance of what Jesus is trying to communicate here in this parable, we need to listen to the whole story, not just the part that's comfortable. And I think, actually, it's really, in some ways, there's a psychology here. It's the uncomfortableness of the Pharisees and the scribes with being confronted by how different Jesus was, and their unwillingness to really deal with that own discomfort in a really honest and responsible way. That's part of the problem here.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead. Were you going to compare the older son to the Pharisees?
Well, let's wait and see.
Sorry.
That's okay. So let's look at this parable. The first section in the parable describes the younger son and his father. And the younger son said to his father, "Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me." And he divided his wealth between them. So the older son, it's saved for him. It's there, okay? And not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country. And there he squandered his estate with loose living. Now when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be in need. And he went and attached himself to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into the fields to feed swine. And he was longing to fill his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. But when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I am dying here with hunger? I will get up and go to my father and will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men.' And he got up and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his slaves, "Quickly bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found." And they began to be merry. Okay, this section of this parable is about how this younger son, the younger of two sons, sort of in his search for freedom, takes the share of his inheritance. He leaves his father's house. He travels to a distant country, and he squanders it all. He spends it all. He spends it all on loose living. And there's this famine, and it's all gone. And so he's wasted everything, and now he's impoverished, and now he's hungry, and he's starving. So what he does is he hires himself out as a hired worker, and he's eating the pods that you normally feed swine. This is the leftovers from corn. You know, it's thrown to the pigs, and that's what he's eating. Through the pain of his own consequences, he kind of comes to his senses and he realizes how unworthy he is and really how stupid he is, because he thinks, Even the guys, even the hired hands at my father's place, they've got it better than this. And he realizes that he's really been foolish. He's really done a bad thing. He realizes that his relationship with his father is more important than what he was after. And he decides to return to his father. So in the process of returning, he's on his way back. His father sees him. His father runs to him. He feels compassion for him and mercy and empathy. He runs out and he welcomes him home. He embraces him. He kisses him. The father accepts his son back fully as a son. And he reestablishes him in this position of honor. He puts this ring on his hand. He puts sandals on his feet. He gives him this robe. And in addition, the father commands the servants to sort of prepare this feast, this big feast. They kill this fatted calf, which is a big deal. And they have this party, which celebrates the fact that this son who was lost is now found, who was dead is now alive. So this is the perspective that the father has towards the younger son. So the conclusion of this parable is that the younger son in this parable represents the tax gatherers and sinners, and that have come to listen to Jesus, that are following Jesus. Like the younger son, they realize that they have left the father, that they had left the father for the things of this world. Like the younger son, they realize that having a relationship with the father is really a much better deal than what they've got. That the father really has something to offer them that is much better, much greater for them than what they had. Like the younger son, they are aware that they have sinned against the father. And like the younger son, they recognize their need for forgiveness. And like the younger son, they recognize the mercy and compassion of the father. And like the younger son, who returns to his father, these men, the tax gatherers and sinners, are returning to the father through Jesus. Okay, that's the moral of that story. The second section of this parable describes the interaction between the father and the older son. Let me read that for quickly. Verses 25 through 32. Now his older son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. And he summoned on one of the servants and began inquiring what these things might be. And he said to him, the servant said to him, "Your brother has come home, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound." But he, the older son, became angry and was not willing to go in. And his father came out and began entreating him. But he answered and said to the father, "Look, for so many years I've been serving you, and I've never neglected a command of yours. And yet you have never given me a kid that I might be merry with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your wealth with harlots, you killed the fattened calf for him." And he said to him, and this is the father, said to him, "My child, you have always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to be merry and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has become to live and was lost and has been found." This section of the parable is about the older son. He has been out in the field, dutifully working, sweating for a long time. He comes into the house. He hears all this ruckus, this music, this party. And he's wondering, what in the heck is going on? In discovering what's going on, the servant tells him, "There's this party for your brother. He's back." The older brother becomes incensed. He's angry. And he refuses to go in and celebrate. So the father comes out and he says, "Come on in, celebrate. Hey, we're having a party. Your brother's back." And this guy, this brother is just enraged that this father would have this party for this younger brother who's squandered his estate on loose living and women and all this other stuff. He's enraged. And he self-righteously and sort of emphatically states that he's done all this work. He's done all this work for the father, and he's earned this thing. His younger brother hasn't earned a thing. He's blown it. And yet he's worked really hard, and the father hasn't given him any party. That's the attitude of the older brother. His father graciously responds to the oldest son, and he tells him that everything that he has is his. He is to the oldest son what he is to the youngest son. He is simply celebrating the return of the youngest son who was lost. The older son in this parable represents the scribes and the Pharisees. Like the older son who was critical of how the father responded to the return of the younger brother, the scribes and the Pharisees were critical of Jesus and his association with tax gatherers and sinners. Like the older son who dutifully did all that he thought the father wanted him to do, so also the scribes and the Pharisees devoted themselves to obeying the law. Like the older son who thought that obedience to the father earned him the father's blessings, so also the scribes and the Pharisees believed that it was effort that earned them God's grace. And like the older son who did not see his need for mercy, so also the scribes and the Pharisees did not see their need for mercy because they earned it. They did it the old-fashioned way. They earned it. The father throughout this parable represents God. Like the father in the parable who feels compassion and welcomes back his son, Jesus has come to welcome back those in need of forgiveness. Though perceived very differently by the oldest son, the father is the same to both sons. Though perceived very differently by the scribes and the Pharisees, God is the same to them that he is to the tax gatherers and the sinners. He is generous, he is compassionate, he is understanding, he is forgiving, and he is merciful. Okay, this is not a nice story. Jesus is confronting this attitude and this perception of the scribes and the Pharisees and how they think about God and how they're to relate to God, and then how that perception plays itself out in their thinking about themselves and they're thinking about how they relate or how they think about other people who are different from them. Jesus is getting in their face. He's confronting them. And you know what they did? They killed him. This is why they killed him. I mean, this isn't only why they killed him, but this is a piece of why they killed him. Because he told them that they were wrong. He told them that they had it wrong. And rather than look at it, rather than think about it and say, help me understand, they weren't willing to do that. They wanted this, they stayed between the lines of their own lines as they defined it for themselves, and they killed him. Because he was outside the lines and he was a threat to them. And that's the psychology of what was going on here. Questions? Yeah.
How wrong is he? You're getting in his face. It seems like he is appreciating, at least in an offhand way. And the older son is saying, "It's great. You're always with me, and all that I have is yours."
But I think what the parable is illustrating there is the character of the father, not the character of the son, in that respect. That's what it's emphasizing there. The character of the son, or the older son, is very clear. He is incensed that the father would give this party for the younger son. He's enraged. He's not going to go in and celebrate. He's not even going to be a part of it, which is very reflective of the Pharisees and the scribes' attitudes towards the sinners and the tax gatherers. They're not even going to go near them. They're not going to associate with them.
So he leaves it open-ended because he doesn't tell us what attitudes the older son takes, because it's conceivable that a Pharisee could say, oh, I'm in a good position after all.
Yeah, he does leave it open-ended. But we know the end of the story.
We're just completely invested in being right.
Complete.
And if Jesus were right, then that meant they were wrong.
Exactly.
No middle ground.
Zero.
And it was their self-reliance.
That's exactly right.
That's exactly right. It was their self. I mean, this whole system that they had, this very narrow, rigid system, was based on self-reliance. And Jesus is saying, this whole relationship with the younger son, which is illustrated by the relationship of the father with the younger son, is based on mercy, not self-reliance. And that's it. And that is a total difference. I'm trying to find this word. Difference of, I mean, there's no middle ground there. There's no putting those two together.
But the interesting thing is that open-endedness that comes from God, that even to that Pharisee and scribe, it's still available.
Oh, yeah, I mean, Jesus told them the parable. Exactly.
If Jesus is portraying this thing from the Father of grace, even for the Pharisee who's got a bad attitude,
right.
The older son,
right.
Then how come in so many other places Jesus yells at them and tells them basically that they're going to hell? Grace only conditional on their acceptance of it?
No. I think you see Jesus being different, given different circumstances, given what's at stake or what's being said about the Father. For example, he goes into the temple one time and he does the whip thing. And I think that I'm not sure that I completely understand what is all going on there, but I think there's a sense of righteous indignation that's going on, that these people are making money at the expense, and I think there's a twisting, perverting what their perspective of God would be. Well, not just the people, but misrepresenting this whole thing about God, and so he goes in there and he's really angry about it, about that. So I think you see Jesus. I don't think it's inconsistent. I think you just see Jesus responding differently to different circumstances, or what's at risk or what's at stake, kind of thing. So I don't think, I mean, there are lots of times, like I think what he's doing here, he's not jumping up and down and screaming, but he's telling them the truth. And that, through the medium of a parable, and that truth is very confrontive. It's very offensive to them. And in the end, they killed him. I mean, they got it. On one level, they got it. They got the fact that Jesus was saying that they were wrong. They got that much.
There were some Pharisees that got saved, though. Could God let them in there, so. Just mine.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a part of us, we're all Pharisees. I mean, thanks.
Proper and anxious that we're.
Sure. Yeah, but let's apply it here. I mean, we all have this tendency towards self-reliance. I mean, that's really what this is about. I mean, we can look at this parable and we can think, oh, this is a story 2,000 years ago. But what the reality of the parable is that Jesus is addressing this attitude, this perception, this thing that's alive in us, that we have this tendency towards self-reliance. Rather, it feels a whole lot better. We feel like we have a little more control. It's real tangible. That's what Jesus is confronting. And that's true in us. So we have the same stuff going here that the Pharisees had going. I mean, even as believers, we're real conflicted. We're in process here. We readily often trust ourselves and go for self-reliance. I mean, look in a mirror, look around you. It's, you know.
To me too, that, I mean, and given the context of this gathering or whatever was going on, that what I could imagine the Pharisees, even a number of Pharisees saying, okay, you know, God's a big God. And if he wants to find some way that he is going to save, or find a place in the kingdom of God for these sinners and tax gatherers, they might even say, well, you know, I think we could let God do that. But clearly, the place that we have in the kingdom of God is a truly a great place. It's a high place.
Right.
And the parable is saying, you know, this
this great place that you guys think you're going to have, that mercy that God extends to everybody. Mm-hmm. And these people that right now you're despising, they will have equal status in the kingdom of God along with everybody else.
Yeah, I think Jesus is saying that, but it's sort of he's saying it on the flip side of the coins of that. He's saying it's not that we have equal status, it's that in a sort of funny way, Jesus is saying you need forgiveness just as much as they do, but you don't know it.
And that the irony is these people that you hate are probably going to be in the kingdom of God and you guys probably won't be.
That's right.
And it seems to me too that when the Father comes to the older son at the end and says, "My child, you've always been with me and all that is mine is yours,"
right.
He doesn't say, you know, "Look, older son, you know, you're right. You hold the higher position here. You have earned it.
Right.
You know, don't worry. This party here doesn't mean that I'm somehow, you know, shunning you."
Right.
You know, he's not saying that.
That's right.
You know, he's saying that, look, you know, all this is available just for you too.
Just like the younger son.
Yeah.
Right.
And that really
it's about mercy. It isn't about earning it.
Right.
That's what he's saying.
And it's on the Father's terms.
That's right.
That's exactly right.
So in a sense, it's open-ended, but it seems that in the context, it's not as open-ended as it might seem. Because
he's being very clear. Jesus is being real clear. I mean, these guys, again, like I say, they killed him. They knew what he was saying. They were saying they were wrong. They were saying that he was saying that their whole thing about self-reliance and trusting on themselves and all this stuff is not the way that God is doing it here. That's not the program.
I was just going to say that even though Jesus said that, he did say it in a merciful way. Because
yes.
Yeah. Especially in the first two parables, it would be possible for someone to find themselves somewhere in that parable. I mean, if they truly, in their heart, were glad that the sinners were coming to being saved, then they could find themselves as one of the friends of God. And he didn't really point his finger at any individual person. So.
Well, the whole point of the parable is to try to communicate truth in a palatable way, in a way that you tell this story, and there's a moral to the story. Instead of coming out and directly saying, you know, you've got it wrong, and this is how you think about it, and blah, blah, and do, blah, 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 kind of thing, Jesus is telling this story. I mean, on one hand, it's easy to listen to a story, and yet there's this message, there's this truth in this story that's very confrontive. So he is telling them the truth, but he's using a story to tell them the truth so that hopefully that they'll get it, so that they'll see it. He's not writing them off and walking away from them. He's relating to them. He's telling them the truth. And he's doing it in a way that's hopefully that they'll get it. I mean, he's not making it hard for them not to see it.
He's appealing to them.
Yeah.
Yes, he is.
He's not just preaching them. Trying to...
Yeah, he says...
What man among you? He's kind of saying, doesn't this make sense to you? Come on.
In a sense, he's kind of appealing to them to say, mm-hmm. Look what great opportunity you guys, being sort of these religious pillars of the community, what great opportunity you have here with the position that we hold in society to start associating with these same people who desperately need salvation. Just as much as you do.
Well, I think he's more saying that if you were a friend of God, you'd be doing that, rather than what a great opportunity. I mean, maybe an opportunity in a sense to really demonstrate God's mercy in that sense. But I think he's saying, if you were really a friend of God, this would be your attitude, and since this isn't your attitude, you're really not a friend of God. You're not the friend of God that you think you are.
No.
That's really more it, I think.
the attitude that you're talking about is celebrating or going to God and asking for mercy?
Both. Both. In the sense, the attitude of realizing the value that God has over people who are lost. That attitude was in direct contradiction to the attitude that the Pharisees and the scribes had over the sinners and tax gatherers. Okay, so he's contrasting those two, and he's saying this is God's attitude, this is yours, and they don't never the twain shall meet. Then he's saying, and your attitude towards me associating with these people is in conflict with how God thinks about this. About me doing this. And the moral of the parable is if you're a friend of God, if you, like the woman and the shepherd, if you're a friend of God, then you would rejoice. And since you're not rejoicing, logic, you must not be a friend of God. Sure, yes.
I don't know if that's my question a long time. Why Jesus said a servant father, not the God the Father?
Oh, it's because it's just a story that he's using to illustrate.
When I became a Christian, I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of hard for me to understand why this prodigal son wanted to stay with this certain father.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not the father in heaven.
Right.
I mean, like that, just father, whatever it is.
In so your question is, why would the older son want to be with this father?
No, I mean, I understand totally now that whole discussions, but just a certain father caused so much conflict inside of me.
Oh, I see.
Well, because there is no perfect father rather than this kind of heavenly father.
Right.
Right. It's just because it's just a story. And he's trying to make an analogy to, or teach them a truth, a reality about God. That's why. Robbie?
Bothering me, and that's the actual looking at the story itself apart from, I mean, you know, looking at a parable, you have to understand the story first apart from what Jesus was making the point with.
Right.
And in the story, the older son actually did what was right, and the younger son did what was wrong. And so, I don't think that the analogy can extend one to one with the Pharisees and the older son, because during all that time that the son was out doing what was wrong, the older son was staying and doing what was right. So his attitude about that was okay.
Well, his behavior was okay. His attitude was wrong.
Well, okay, but
his motive was wrong.
Why he was doing it was wrong is really what Jesus is questioning here. Not the fact that he was working, or it's why he was working. That's the problem.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is I don't think that Jesus is really commenting about his attitude about why he was working. He's commenting on, I mean, I would say when Gabe brought up that, is he talking about celebrating or is he talking about mercy? And that, at that particular point, I think he's talking more about celebrating. The son does not understand. I mean, in all those three parables, the thing that's important about each one of them is there's something that's lost, and there's something that's found, and it's a joyous occasion.
Right.
And so,
the last parable goes farther and says something that the first two parables don't say, and that is that the older son makes this comments about, he says, he became angry and was not willing to go in, and his father came out and began entreating him, but he answered and said to the father, look, for so many years I've been serving you, and I've never neglected a commandment of yours, and yet you have never given me this kid. So it's like, I've earned this. That's his attitude. And I think this parable goes farther than the first two.
I suppose the problem that I'm having, and I can't quite sort it out, but in terms of human endeavor, I don't mean in terms of God's mercy.
Okay.
In terms of human endeavor, he did earn it. I mean, yes. He did do what was right. And so to me, it's important to make the distinction. I mean, that there's a difference between, first, not everything in the story, Jesus was telling a story, not everything in the story corresponds one-to-one with the Pharisees, because I don't know that we could look at the Pharisees and say everything they were doing was right.
Sure.
But in the story, understanding the story, I mean, the son did do what was right. And he did earn a place, I mean, he was earning his inheritance in a sense. So that part I don't think corresponds to what Jesus was saying.
Well, I think in Jesus' economy, though, from his perspective, you don't earn inheritance.
But he seems to say, doesn't he say that you did? He seemed to say you belong here.
That's what I'm saying, too. He didn't tell the older son, you're wrong, now you get out.
Yeah.
So he is telling, he is praising his obedience.
Yeah, I wonder though if it isn't more of a commentary on the character of the father rather than about the son, the older son, or whether he's earned this or whether he's done what's right or not. I think it's a comment about the father.
Part of the thing would be maybe understanding how do people or should people think about inheritance in the sense that. Does a son ever really inherit, earn an inheritance? And one of the things is that maybe we might be making being confused by the son saying, look, for so many years I have been serving you, etc.
Right.
With the father saying, my child, you have always been with me. The father might not be saying, by saying you have always been with me, by saying, yeah, you're right, you've done everything right and you have earned your inheritance, so don't worry. It isn't necessarily, I mean, the father isn't necessarily repeating back to the son, okay, I give you all that, right, you earned it.
Right.
This, my child, you've always been with me, that doesn't necessarily mean that. It could have a different kind of connotation. I'm not sure. I mean, it could be kind of saying, essentially, It's true, unlike your brother, you weren't arduously just running, fleeing from...
You stayed here.
Yeah. You know, but at the same time, he's not necessarily conceding and saying, you're right, you've earned it. It's still very much in the father's court to say, you know, the inheritance is something that I give you because I want to or because I will... Based on who I am, not based on what
you earned. It would be interesting. It would be interesting to look at how they all thought about inheritances and all that stuff, and whether they were perceived as gifts or whether they were perceived as something that.
I could imagine at this time the concept of an inheritance was a really big thing compared to us now, and we don't bring that same amount of information.
There's a couple of issues that I feel, and one of them is what Robbie was saying, and kind of connected to what you were saying earlier about the Pharisee's perspective. If the Pharisees and scribes, they care about the law. I mean, they really care. At least
it's important
to
them.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe they're completely kind of perverted about it, but I could see themselves kind of caring about what is right and good and God's law and God, and you know, they don't want to blow it like their fathers did that got them hauled off to Babylon. You know, they're trying to obey God. They care, and they see Jesus lining up with these guys. Who seemingly don't care about the law. I mean, and I can relate to that. I'm not saying that I do the law or that I'm right, but I could see just being kind of a normal, average citizen who basically tries to keep the laws and do what's right versus somebody out there who's just out of control, totally running amok, not caring about anybody else but their own self-interest.
Yeah.
I could see where if Jesus was aligning himself with people who aren't, who don't supposedly care. If that is in fact the picture, now maybe I have a wrong see, that would be really hard. Mm-hmm. But I also see what you're saying. The prodigal son's brother was really clear that he felt he deserved that.
Right.
And
there's a sense of entitlement there.
Yeah. And actually I can relate to that too in my family situation. I mean, I've watched, you know, there's my brother and there's me, and he's kind of taken what he's, you know, mm-hmm. done stuff, and it's kind of like, I can really relate to that. Mm-hmm. So the tension is between caring about the law and yet having, I guess, the self-awareness that you don't really deserve anything. And maybe trying to understand that even though you care, doesn't mean you're doing it and making it and you deserve what you think you
need. If you recognize that you're in need of forgiveness and mercy, that's sort of goes, knowing that you don't deserve it sort of goes with that. It's all in the same.
Yes, so if the issue really is pivotal, your own self-concept of needing mercy and forgiveness, I could see that, I mean, that's really got to be it, more than...
I think that's what it's about, is their self-concept, and then how that played itself out.
Yeah.
I was just kind of looking at it from the perspective of the father not delving into when he said you've always been with me, not digging into saying with your heart. I think it's been more like you've always been with me here on this land, working it with me
right.
in my house. Right. And I kind of, since he was speaking to the Pharisees and the scribes,
yeah.
they're in the same place. They're in God's church, or they go to they went to the synagogues, and they have always been in there.
Yeah.
Okay, and so that's how I was kind of looking at it, always been with me.
That could be.
But, and you know, and then we get back to the point of, you know, the motives of why they were actually there and how they were actually were in the heart.
Right.
And so I think we kind of...
What does correlate here, though, is the criticism that the older brother has towards the younger brother
yeah.
and the father.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the scribes and Pharisees' criticism of Jesus...
Mm-hmm.
of associating
oh,
with...
Yeah. And I have no problem with that. I think that when they're saying that you've always been with me, I kind of thought, you know, you've always gone to church, all right, and you've always done all this other stuff, which,
yeah.
according to that...
Done the right thing.
Yeah, quote-unquote. Or not even, you know, yeah, done the right thing, but you've always been in my church physically.
Yeah.
Like, he was physically there on the land doing what asked, and that's...
Yeah.
I think in response to yours and your comments about the fact that it feels like, hey, I've been doing all this stuff, I'm here, why don't I get the party? I think that there's rewards to being there and to being part of the church. The Pharisees had the money and had the respect and all the rest of that stuff. What the father points out to the Pharisees, or the older son in here, is that you've always been with me. Everything I have is yours. You're complaining about the fact that I've never given you a kid to celebrate. All the stuff I have is yours. You can have this relationship. You can have all this. And the younger son, although he gets a big celebration or whatever, he spent all this time off in a foreign country eating pig food.
You know,
it's not nearly as good as what the son has who's staying there.
Is he saying how I think about you and how I think about the younger son are the same?
Yeah. The inheritance, you guys both have that. You're my sons, you have that.
So he's really saying
something. You've had the advantage of being here and getting to use all this stuff, and the younger son hasn't. Let's be happy that he's come back and not begrudge him being able to have this again.
I think we have to be careful how far we take these stories or kind of thing. Robbie.
Okay, let me see if a new thought came to me. Okay. Let me see if I can make it clear on something.
Okay.
I'm not, the things that you're talking about, not deserving mercy and things like that, that's random. What I'm thinking, though, is that that's not the point of the parable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the point of the parable is the celebratory nature of what God's friends, the other point that you said about
right.
how we would celebrate over this thing is lost.
Right.
Because I think in the story taken by itself, if you didn't even have the Pharisees there and Jesus was just telling the story, in the story, the son did what was right. So in a sense, Jesus could be saying to the Pharisees, and in a way, I don't know what their inheritance things were, but there is a sense in that in some areas of life, we do earn what we get. I mean, if you have a job, you earn,
right.
You deserve the wage that you get. The son in the parable, he did what was right, and in a sense, I think the father was saying, this stuff all belongs to you.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm thinking, I don't think that has much to do about whether or not he deserves mercy. I think that's in the Bible, but that's not here.
Right.
And yet, he's saying, okay, assuming Jesus could be telling the Pharisees, okay, assume that you are like the older son, and that from your perspective, you have done everything that's right. He's not talking about whether or not they have, but assume that you have done everything that's right. Still, there's something that you don't understand, and that is what God thinks about someone who is lost, and the joy that you should be feeling for me as the father, because this son that I had was lost and now I found him. And so the thing that's the point that he's making in the parable and the thing that's wrong is not, it doesn't really have anything to do about what he deserves because of what he's done.
Right.
That's just kind of part of the story. But the point, and it goes along with the other two parables that you pointed
right.
to, is the joy. There's something wrong with the Pharisees, he's saying,
right.
because, as you said, they can't be friends of God because they don't understand how God feels about the joy that he has
right.
when somebody's lost. That's kind of what I'm saying.
Thank you, Mark.
I think along with her point, what this parable is really showing is it's the grace of God that covers the son that ran away.
Right.
Where, yes, the other son stayed there, did his work, and he's rewarded for that. But I think he's really trying to show the Pharisees here that it's the grace of God that covers both sons in those situations.
What I'm struck with is that the Pharisees had nothing to lose. As the son, the good son, or the son that stayed home had nothing to lose except to recognize who they were and who God was. But the Pharisees, because of their self-reliance and their need to look good and be right, it left no room.
Say that again. Say all that again.
Well, I don't know if I can. It seems like they had nothing to lose. That last sentence that the father says is just, I don't think I ever really saw that.
Yeah.
And I can see myself as a Pharisee. So even in that state, that inheritance, that grace is still available to me.
Right.
All I have to do is recognize my need for it.
Right.
Which the Pharisees simply couldn't do.
Right. One last question, then we stop.
Well, it's the last question, Roger.
Do you have your hand raised?
Yes.
Okay, we'll go to you.
It's the old give and go.
Go for it.
If I may play the part of the Pharisee, then I would say to Jesus, I would say, look, the prodigal son gets off pretty easy. Look at him.
Yes.
He got the inheritance. He's getting, not the inheritance, but he's getting the approval of the father.
Yeah.
And look what he did. He went out and he's sinning.
I'm the father, and I say,
are you encouraging sin by giving him the same?
When I say, I'm the father, and I say, I give mercy to who I will give mercy when I want to give mercy.
Yeah, believe it.
Thank you. All those are great questions.